6. The Hero as World Redeemer. 2 degrees of initiation are to be distinguished in the mansion of the Father. From the first, the Son returns as emissary, but from the second, with the knowledge that I and the Father are one. Heroes of this second, highest illumination are the world redeemers, the so-called incarnations in the highest sense. Their myths open out to cosmic proportions. Their words carry an authority beyond anything pronounced by the heroes of the scepter and the book. The hero of the Jicarilla Apache, killer of enemies, said,
"All of you watch me. Don't look around. Listen to what I say. The world is just as big as my body. The world is as large as my word. And the world is as large as my prayers. The sky is only as large as my words and prayers. The seasons are only as great as my body, my words, and my prayer. It is the same with the waters. My body, my words, my prayer are greater than the waters. Whoever believes me, whoever listens to what I say, will have long life. One who doesn't listen, who thinks in some evil way, will have a short life. Don't think I am in the east, south, west, or north. The earth is my body. I am there. I am all over. Don't think I stay only under the earth or up in the sky, or only in the seasons, or on the other side of the waters. These are all my body. It is the truth that the underworld, the sky, the seasons, the waters are all my body. I am all over. I have already given you that with which you have to make an offering to me. You have 2 kinds of pipe, and you have the mountain tobacco."
The work of the incarnation is to refute by his presence the pretensions of the tyrant ogre. The latter has occluded the source of grace with the shadow of his limited personality. The incarnation, utterly free of such ego consciousness, is a direct manifestation of the law. On a grandiose scale, he enacts the hero life, performs the hero deeds, slays the monster. But it is all with the freedom of a work done only to make evident to the eye what might have been accomplished equally well with a mere thought. Kans, the cruel uncle of Krishna, usurper of his own father's throne in the city of Mathura, heard a voice one day that said to him, "Thy enemy is born. Thy death is certain." Krishna and his elder brother Balarama had been spirited to the cowherds from their mother's womb to protect them from this Indian counterpart of Nimrod, and he had sent demons after him. Putana of the poisoned milk was the first, but all had been undone. Now, when his devices had failed, Kans determined to lure the youths to his city. A messenger was sent to invite the cowherds to a sacrifice and great tournament. The invitation was accepted. With the brothers among them, the cowherds came and camped outside the city wall. Krishna and Balarama, his brother, went in to see the wonders of the town. There were great gardens, palaces, and groves. They encountered a washerman and asked him for some fine clothes. When he laughed and refused, they took the clothes by force and made themselves very gay. Then a humpbacked woman prayed Krishna to let her rub sandal paste on his body. He went up to her, placing his feet on hers, and with 2 fingers beneath her chin, lifted her up and made her straight and fair. And he said, "When I have slain Kans, I shall come back and be with you." The brothers came to the empty stadium. There the bow of the god Shiva was set up, huge as 3 palm trees, great and heavy. Krishna advanced to the bow, pulled it, and it broke with a mighty noise. Kans in his palace heard the sound and was appalled. The tyrant sent his troops to kill the brothers in the city, but the lads slew the soldiers and returned to their camp. They told the cowherds they had had an interesting tour, then ate their suppers and went to bed. Kans that night had ominous dreams. When he woke, he ordered the stadium prepared for the tournament and the trumpets blown for assembly. Krishna and Balarama arrived as jugglers, followed by the cowherds, their friends. When they entered the gate, there was a furious elephant ready to crush them, mighty as 10,000 common elephants. The driver rode it directly at Krishna. Balarama gave it such a blow with his fist that it halted, started back. The driver rode it again, but the two brothers struck it to the ground, and it was dead. The youths walked onto the field. Everybody saw what his own nature revealed to him. The wrestlers thought Krishna a wrestler. The women thought him the treasure of beauty. The gods knew him as their lord. And Kans thought he was Mara, death himself. When he had undone every one of the wrestlers sent against him, slaying finally the strongest, he leapt to the royal dais, dragged the tyrant by the hair, and killed him. Men, gods, and saints were delighted. But the king's wives came forth to mourn. Krishna, seeing their grief, comforted them with his primal wisdom. "Mother," he said, "do not grieve. No one can live and not die. To imagine oneself as possessing anything is to be mistaken. Nobody is father, mother, or son. There is only the continuous round of birth and death." The legends of the Redeemer describe the period of desolation as caused by a moral fault on the part of man. Adam in the garden, Jamshid on the throne. Yet from the standpoint of the cosmogonic cycle, a regular alternation of fair and foul is characteristic of the spectacle of time. Just as in the history of the universe, so also in that of nations. Emanation leads to dissolution, youth to age, birth to death, form creative vitality to the dead weight of inertia. Life surges, precipitating forms, and then ebbs, leaving jetsam behind. The Golden Age, the reign of the world emperor, alternates in the pulse of every moment of life with the wasteland, the reign of the tyrant. The god who is the creator becomes the destroyer in the end. From this point of view, the tyrant ogre is no less representative of the father than the earlier world emperor, whose position he usurped, or than the brilliant hero, the son, who is to supplant him. He is the representative of the set fast, as the hero is the carrier of the changing. And since every moment of time bursts free from the fetters of the moment before, so this dragon, hold fast, is pictured as of the generation immediately preceding that of the Savior of the world. Stated in direct terms, the work of the hero is to slay the tenacious aspect of the father, dragon, tester, ogre king, and release from its ban the vital energies that will feed the universe.
This can be done either in accordance with the father's will or against his will. He, the father, may choose death for his children's sake, or it may be that the gods impose the passion upon him, making him their sacrificial victim. These are not contradictory doctrines, but different ways of telling one and the same story. In reality, slayer and dragon, sacrificer and victim, are of one mind behind the scenes, where there is no polarity of contraries, but mortal enemies on the stage, where the everlasting war of the gods and the titans is displayed. In any case, the dragon father remains a pleroma, no more diminished by what he exhales than he is increased by what he repossesses. He is the death on whom our life depends. And to the question, is death one or many, the answer is made that he is one as he is there, but many as he is in his children here.
The hero of yesterday becomes the tyrant of tomorrow, unless he crucifies himself today. From the point of view of the present, there is such a recklessness in this deliverance of the future that it appears to be nihilistic. The words of Krishna, the world savior, to the wives of the dead Kans carry a frightening overtone. So do the words of Jesus, "I came not to send peace, but a sword, for I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against her mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foes shall be they of his own household. He that loveth father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and he that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." To protect the unprepared, mythology veils such ultimate revelations under half-obscuring guises while yet insisting on the gradually instructive form. The savior figure who eliminates the tyrant father and then himself assumes the crown is, like Oedipus, stepping into his sire's stead. To soften the harsh patricide, the legend represents the father as some cruel uncle or usurping Nimrod. Nevertheless, the half-hidden fact remains. Once it is glimpsed, the entire spectacle buckles. The son slays the father, but the son and the father are one. The enigmatical figures dissolve back into the primal chaos. This is the wisdom of the end and re-beginning of the world.